Floodgate Broadcasting.
Thursday. Jeez, we're almost halfway through the month of June. 2 weeks into it. Tomorrow marks the halfway point. And oh man. Anyway, debating which topic I was going to cover tonight. There's any number of directions I'm getting pulled in. I've been getting some personal requests too for stuff. The Churchill thing, I want to get to that soon. I want to cover something I put together years ago. But it's now more pertinent than ever, especially where the movie just came out on the topic. I'm going to be covering the Chappaquiddick incident pretty soon here. Very interesting story behind that we've never been told. So I'll be getting to that in coming on coming shows the next couple of weeks or so. But for tonight, I thought I'd get into, since I mentioned it yesterday, it ties in with stuff we were talking about yesterday, the parabiosis topic, this idea of the elites ingesting the blood of children as a means of maintaining youthfulness and longevity. Yes, that's what they're doing. Oh, there's other reasons they do it, bizarre, twisted, occultic reasons. But this is another one to add to the list. They consider the blood of children to be, like a fountain of youth, if you will. And there's apparently scientific reasons for doing it, which is even more scary. The August 4th, 2014 edition of The Guardian, for example, carried an article called, "Can We Reverse the Aging Process by Putting Young Blood into Older People?" Can you imagine, folks, that they would even ask that question? They throw this out there just to get you to go, to open your mind to the possibility so that it sounds acceptable, certainly not shocking. Acceptable and even, something beneficial. The article stated in part, a series of experts has produced incredible results by giving young blood to old mice. Now the findings are being tested on humans. In other words, they started in the lab by giving young mice blood to older mice. Now they're beginning, they're not beginning. They want you to think that, oh, now we're testing it on humans. This has been going on a long time, folks. I guarantee you, they got this thing down pat. But anyway, now the findings are being tested on humans. See, first they get you to accept the idea that, oh, well, hey, that's a good idea. Yeah, tested it on mice, young blood of mice to old mice. Now we're testing it on humans. But nobody stops to ask the big question, where exactly are you getting the young human blood from? How are you getting this young human blood? you're supposed to just be left wondering, assuming that it's all above board, because we all know that everything our government does, everything the big multinational corporations do, is always above board. Why, we know that criminal activity is only relegated to the dregs of society. They are the real dregs of society, but you know what I mean. Just the low-level thugs on the streets, right? The article went on to reveal that research was being carried out at the Veterans Affairs Hospital in Palo Alto, California, that involved pairs of surgically conjoined mice that shared a blood supply for several weeks. Young mice received blood from older mice, and old mice received blood from younger ones, testing back and forth, see what the effects would be. One of the researchers, a student named Paul Valida, wanted to see the effect on the brains of each mouse. In a nutshell, it was discovered that the old mice that received young mouse blood, experienced a burst of brain cell growth in the hippocampus, the area of the brain, crucial for memory and learning. By the way, I'm a little puzzled by that, because I had always thought that brain cells don't reproduce, but this is implying that the older mice who got younger mice blood showed a burst in brain cell growth. What the hell does that mean? Does that mean the brain cells grew in size? I think we're supposed to assume that they grew in number, but is it just human brain cells that don't regenerate? You always hear those stories, don't drink too much, you're going to kill your brain cells. And I've read, in scientific textbooks that brain cells don't regenerate. When you lose them, they're gone. That's it. But according to this, I don't know. Or maybe mice cells regenerate or can regrow, but not human. Anyway, they had 3 to 4 times as many newborn neurons as their counterparts. So there you go, newborn neurons. So, either what I was reading was incorrect, scientific textbook. But then again, scientific textbooks aren't always correct now, are they? I don't know. That was just always my understanding. I didn't think brain cells could regenerate, but according to this study, they do. Conversely, it was also found that old blood had the opposite effect on the brains of young mice, stalling the birth of new neurons and leaving them looking old before their time. So there is, there has been studies done show that young blood in mice, older mice, can create conditions of youthfulness, and vice versa. Old blood and young mice create conditions of, how do you like that? It sounds fascinating conceptually, but think of the moral implications of this, guys. Just like cloning, technically it sounds fascinating, doesn't it? But look at the moral implications of that. And look how that, turns people into guinea pigs, right? How many people have been inducted into laboratory experiments without even knowing it? Anyway. While this discovery, again, certainly sounds fascinating enough, the implications are pretty scary. Because as the article stated, quote, now the findings are being tested on humans. So what does that mean? They're giving old, they're not only taking blood from young people, right, from kids and giving them to elderly people. They're also taking blood from elderly people and giving that to young kids to to retard their development? I mean, is that what we're looking at here? Obviously, that's what they're doing, right? That's what the article says. How do you get volunteers for that, guys? They're not getting volunteers, are they? Of course not. They're doing this without people knowing. I mean, look how it came out back in the 90s. Bill Clinton admitted this, that over 100,000 people, beginning in the early post-World War II era, over 100,000 people during the late 40s, 50s, into the 60s, 70s, were being experimented on without their knowledge or consent in major hospitals and medical facilities and research facilities around the country. Over 100,000. That's what's admitted. You can bet it's worse than that. But so, you know, if that crap was going on back then, God damn it, you think they stopped?
Oh, they reformed their ways now. They realized that was wrong. Just like MK Ultra. Yeah, oh, yeah, that's a thing of the past. Yeah. Yeah, they did do it in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. But, you know, once it got exposed, then they stopped doing it.
Right. Of course. Just like NASA lost the technology to go to the moon. That's why we haven't gone back. Did you know that? That's another show coming up. I'll save that for later. But that's an official statement NASA has made to explain why we haven't gone back to the moon. They lost the technology. I shit you not. They actually said that. Holy mother of Jesus Christ. Can you believe that? They lost the technology. Yeah, well, hey, believe that. And, you know, send me the check and I'll mail you the bridge. Anyway, so blood and blood plasma is being taken from children and infants, ladies and gentlemen, and being used on ailing adults or senior adults. Likewise, blood from seniors is being taken and being injected into young children. Where's this being done? Who are these people? You know they're not being told. You know that this is involuntary. You know, people are coming in. That's what happened with the experimentation Clinton was talking about. People, for example, were being doused back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, were being doused with radioactive substances. And then, you know, they would go see the doctor again. Oh, come and see me next week. They would go in for like a burn treatment or something, you know, or stitches or whatever. And then they were dousing them with what they thought was some salve to ooze, to soothe their wounds. You know, come back next week. I want to check on it. And what they were really doing is checking on, you know, the effects of the radiation. Oh yeah, look at that! Wow, a cancer tumor developed already. Hey, good news. It's bad news. You have cancer, but good news. We caught it early, so we're going to send you right into surgery now, not knowing that they got the cancer because of shit they doused them with a week before. Fast-acting cancer radiation, cancer-inducing radiation. Anyway, oh, they were doing this in many other ways too. The CIA and the Army, U.S. Army, had a joint program where they were going into subways all over the U.S., hiding behind, gratings, like a ventilation system, you know, and releasing toxins into the air through the grating and taking notes. And, you know, later they would follow up with the local hospital to see who checked in. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's one of the guys that breathed in some of the toxins when he walked by. And so they would monitor the effects. Oh, he died. Well, we know this is effective. We can use that as a biological weapon or a chemical weapon, you know. Holy shit, guys. Even as we speak now, we could very well be victims of some of these tests and not know it. And in another year or two or 5 or 10 years, developed cancer and never know that it had nothing to do with the Lucky Charms we ate for breakfast every morning for 10 years. Oh, that'll do it too. But no. It might actually be due to ingestion, inhalation or whatever, of some shit they were dousing us with without us even knowing. What a sick world, man. They were doing this shit 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. What do you think they're doing now? In a way, no one's exempt from this, right? What do you think the chemtrails are? They're experimenting with all of us. aren't they? Worse than experimenting, they're freaking poisoning us! Anyway, so again, you got to ask, how are they getting this blood from children and infants, ladies and gentlemen? And is a market being created for this purpose? They got to, you know, they're trafficking children enough as it is, right? For all kinds of disgusting, vulgar purposes, unbelievably evil purposes. Could this very well be another one? This might even be, you know, might place children in bigger demand more than anything else now. Many people have emailed me, you know, how is it these bastards live so old? Look at Kissinger. Look at Daddy Bush. Look at, he just popped off recently, but he lived to a ripe old age. Brzezinski, or for that matter, Rockefeller. You wonder how they live well into their 90s, or for all we know, they're probably older than that. Anyway, how serious is this going to get? Or has it already gotten serious? 100,000 kids a year disappear in this country alone, folks. Imagine that. You really think 100,000 kids are getting abducted just by random thugs on the streets? Oh, they exist. We have our share of them, yeah. But not with those kind of statistics. No. We're looking at, I would bet my life on it, that at least 75%, if not more, of that number is, you know, CIA and other intelligence agencies. Oh, yeah. In this country, probably the Mossad is more active with that than the CIA. And probably the bulk of them are being abducted for parabiosis. Use of their blood for youthfulness. Anyway, let's have a closer look at this issue here. The process that we are talking about here, again, is called parabiosis. And there's actually a company in Monterey, California, called Ambrosia, that is a leader in this research. This should frighten the living hell out of us, because the word ambrosia, of course, means food of the gods, ladies and gentlemen. Food of the gods. This company researches using young blood, again, to create, you know, youthfulness in elderly people. Ambrosia, food of the gods. Holy shit. And you know what's even more scary? Apparently, you don't even have to have the blood injected or you know, introduced into your system in a scientific way. Apparently, as long as it's fresh, you can ingest it, and that's what some of these sick bastards do. So that gives the name ambrosia an even more stomach-churning connotation, doesn't it? Food of the gods. We hear so many stories of you know, Abramovic type, you know, spirit cooking exercises, where she's sprinkling blood all over the place, and they're drinking blood at these ceremonies. There you go, guys. It doesn't just have an occult connotation to it. It has this, you know, youthfulness sidekick benefit to it. So, you know, the obvious implication here is that this company, Ambrosia, views the blood of children and infants as food, life-giving food. Do understand that in Satanism, the blood of the sacrificial victim, usually a child, is deemed as energizing and life-giving, and thus it is ingested. And this goes back to very ancient times. Do you think this is just a new scientific discovery, or is this in fact something that has always been known down through the ages? Maybe they're just discovering, you know, the actual reasons for it, but apparently it's been known since ancient times that young blood can, you know, hold off the or reverse the debilitating effects of aging. Don't miss the frightening correlation here. More than just doing research, this company now offers people for a fee of $8,000 to get a blood transfusion with the blood of a child with the promise of reversing the aging process. Did you catch that? For the fee of $8,000, you can get a blood transfusion from this company that will replace your blood with the blood of children. Where are they getting this blood, ladies and gentlemen? Where and how are they getting this freaking blood? Can you believe there's a company that exists that's actually doing this shit? Where's the outrage for that? You got people that will demonstrate outside of Kentucky Fried Chicken because the abuse of chickens, for Christ's sakes. How come nobody's outside this company? If they are, I don't know anything about it. I never heard of any protest for this shit. The hell is going on there? Anyway. I mean, does this not chill you to the bone? Blood of children not only has deep, evil, occult significance, you know, destroying the innocence of a child. They love that. They love violating children, ladies and gentlemen. They get off on it. They feel that it gives them power. That's, you know, the classic pussy bully. Remember, you know, going to school, the bully that would only pick on smaller kids that he knew he could beat up. The bullies never go after kids their size. Certainly not any kids bigger than them, right? I mean, that's what we're dealing with here. These sick son of a bitches get off on picking on the weak. Why do you think the Pentagon always targets third world countries? Not just because they got a lot of rich resources, but they know they can't fucking defend themselves. If a country that had a formidable military and you know, an arsenal of nuclear warheads, they're not going to fucking target them if they got a lot of oil or natural gas or whatever, you know. Of course not. That's the mentality of the psychos that run this world. The psycho will eat you pig pricks. Anyway, the blood of children, again, not only has deep, evil, occult significance. They love to destroy the innocence of children. But, as was just mentioned, it is believed, again, that children's blood halts aging through an ingredient that it contains called Adrenochrome. That is the key ingredient, if you will, that causes a cessation or a halting or a slowing down or whatever of the aging process in the blood of children. A heightened amount of this substance is released into the bloodstream when the target is subjected to extreme fear through abuse. Do you get it? They have it in their bloodstream already as it is, but the levels rise exponentially when the subject is subjected, you know, to trauma, when fear is introduced through abuse. You see what's going on here, guys? So when they abuse these kids, you see how this, oh my fucking word. Oh, they do it not only because they're psychopathic son of a bitches that get off on the suffering of innocent kids. And it probably arouses them sexually, you name it. But again, there's another reason behind this, folks. It increases the production of adrenochrome, and thus they get a greater effect from the ingestion of their blood. Oh my God, this is fucking unbelievable. Like I said, guys, occultists, Satanists have been doing this shit for thousands of years. Maybe now you can understand why the tribe has been committing blood libel for so long down through the centuries. Why do you think they drain the blood. They hang the victims upside down, cut their necks, and drain the blood. What are they doing with that blood? Satanic slash occult literature has talked about this shit, again, guys, since time immemorial. That the blood of the youth, that, you know, Aleister Crowley said that the sacrifice of a young child is the most efficient, the most important, the most, you know, it brings the greatest level of power, blah, 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 blah. They've known this for a long time. But now we have companies operating under the guise of science that are doing this same shit. Where are they getting this blood, guys? Nobody questions this? Somebody with $8,000 to spare can just walk in this door of this clinic, or whatever you want to call it, Ambrosia, and get infused with children's blood, and no questions are asked. They don't even want to know. Hey, by the way, how do you get the... This is incredibly sick stuff. Anyway, the obvious implications here are that the more a child is abused, the more the amount of adrenochrome that the child produces, and thus the greater the anti-aging benefit. Look at this, guys. Look at this. Well, now it's making even more sense, isn't it, when you consider that abominable son of a bitch, Podesta there. Remember that video? I don't know, about 6 months ago that came out on the net where he's beating the shit out of this young girl. You remember that fucking video? Well, we can just take a very educated guess now, very good educated guess as to what the fate of that girl was after her beating, right? In this regard, on January 13th, 2017, MIT Technology Review carried an article called Questionable Young Blood Transfusions Offered in U.S. as Anti-Aging Remedy. MIT's Technical Journal carried an article on this. Questionable, it says. Oh, did you think? Questionable. All right, guys, show thanks right back.
Jews control money, government, media, and academia. Repeat.
Jews are poor. The government and media are anti-Semitic.
Hola! You've just heard Chosen, one of the oldest languages known to ape. Try another. Mayenta is fat, ugly, and Sephardi.
My wife is beautiful, intelligent, and spiritual.
Good job! We have Chosen learning pods in synagogues, lodges, even selected pizza restaurants. Learn Chosen and stay ahead.
Vaccines are safe. The Holocaust was real.
So fluent, so chosen. Fees, obligations, and genital mutilation apply.
We'll be right back. to do it.
All right, guys, welcome back. So, the brains behind this program at Ambrosia is, drum roll, please, a tribe member. His name is Jesse Carmazine, or Carmazine, however you pronounce it. Are you surprised? Who else would you expect to be at the helm of a program like this, ladies and gentlemen? Freaking unbelievable. Let's not mince words here. This practice is nothing short of modern vampirism, period. That's all this is. And the victims here are children. As far as the tribe goes, guess where this concept of blood being life-giving can be traced back to? I mentioned, yeah, it's ancient, right? Satanists, occultists for millennia have believed this. But guess what, guys? Here it is in the not-so-holy book. Leviticus 17, verse 11 states, "For the life of a creature is in the blood, and I, Yahweh, have given it to you to make an atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life." Unbelievable. And again, you got to love it. Bible dupes say that the other religions of the world are centered around death, around blood. Oh, really now? But not yours. Oh, no, not yours. No, no. Your religion features a dead man on a cross with nails in his hands and feet. Your religion isn't about death at all now, is it? Oh, I'm so glad. Fucking idiots. Anyway, in this verse, the idea was being advocated that not only was shedding blood life-giving, but the death of the blood donor brought salvation or eternal life. You get it, guys? Remember that Christian hymn?
There is power, power, power in the blood of the Lamb.
Power in the blood of the Lamb. His shed blood brings life to the believer. And you must drink his blood and eat his flesh in the communion service to benefit from that shed blood. Think about it, guys. This is a very old theme within the tribe, isn't it? Yes, of course it is. Interestingly, researchers into parabiosis have actually used the term immortality, implying that it might be attainable after all with the blood of the young as they perfect this more with further research. Oh, you can bet the blood of children is going to be in ever-increasing demands as they delve into this further. This is incredibly scary stuff, ladies and gentlemen. It's marrying science and occultism to the max. In fact, they're already married. They're working on their honeymoon now. With all this in mind, it's important to note what the great Jesus said. I just made reference to this a minute ago, but here it is. His exact words, as found in John 6:53. Jesus said to them, "Verily I say unto you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you." Imagine that, ladies and gentlemen. That's parabiosis for you right there, isn't it? Of course it is. And here's something else very disturbing. When London police interviewed several children in late 2016 regarding the bust of a major pedo ring over in London, or in England in general, one of the girls told police about an evil man who came to her school every day to engage in sexual activities with various children there, along with school staff. And then she said this, ladies and gentlemen, it's on the police interview tapes. She said, he does sex to us. He kills babies. We eat babies. We drink their blood. There you go. There you go. And now you know the real reason behind it. Yes,
they're psychopaths. Like, you really even need to know the reason? I mean, you know, you drink blood, you're a psychopath, you deserve a bullet in the head.
But this is the reason behind it, guys. Yes, they get off on inflicting suffering, and they love to destroy the innocence of children. That's all true. They would do this anyway. But there is a much higher purpose behind it in their estimation. They're gaining youthfulness by doing this. Interestingly, Al Gore has been known to carry a vial of blood around with him in his briefcase. This is a story that's been circulating for a while, and it comes from sources that you know, have been close to him, that said that, yes, oh yeah, it's well known. All his friends know about it. He'll pull it out and drink it right in front of you. The media, in fact, hasn't even denied this. They admit it. They explain it, though, by saying that he's a hemophiliac. That's why he carries vials of blood. But is this really the reason? Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal, has admitted to not only using young people's blood to extend his life, but he has said that he actually drinks it for this purpose. Drinks it for this purpose. The Out of Mind website reported on June 11th of last year, quote, the billionaire founder of PayPal, Peter Thiel, has admitted to drinking the blood of teenagers in a bid to extend his own lifespan. The 48-year-old has funded startup companies, dedicated to extending the human lifespan. One of them must be Ambrosia, right? California. And he claims that people are conned by the idea of the inevitability of death. In other words, death isn't inevitable. You can attain immortality by drinking children's blood. The article continued, during an interview with Inc.com's Jeff Berkovici, Thiel admitted that he harvests young blood and infuses himself with it in a practice known as parabiosis, there you go, which he claims is the closest modern science has come to creating an anti-aging panacea. According to reports, Thiel spends $40,000 per quarter to get an infusion of blood from a teenager during the process of parabiosis, which means the biological joining of two individuals. This, of course, also fits in with the cannibal theme, which has been popularized with sick shows like Santa Clarita Diet, ladies and gentlemen, starring Drew Barrymore. Remember that sick shit? You see how they're pushing this? They want it, make it acceptable, because this is the norm for them. And they know as time goes on, this is going to come out more and more and more. So they want you to accept it. They want to go way over the top, get as gross, as disgusting as they can, so that nothing shocks you. So when you hear about this, well, it's no big deal. I know about that. Yeah, they got a whole TV series on it. You see what's going on here, guys? Like I said, as sick as the stuff is that we're becoming aware of, I guarantee you, we don't even know 1% of it. Not even 1%. It's far, far worse than you could ever imagine. But this shit, rest assured, this shit is going on a far grander scale than you'd care to know. You just can't make this shit up. And remember the movie Soylent Green, ladies and gentlemen? Yeah, that's all part of the conditioning there too, isn't it? Get you used to this, get you to accept it. It's
It's all the norm now. It's all the rage. Join with us. I don't think I mentioned this before, but there's actually, well, I don't know the name of it or where it is, but quite a few people have talked about this. There's a restaurant in L.A., supposedly, where you can go and get served human meat. It's kind of like, you know, one of those best kept secrets in L.A. You only know about it from word of mouth. And I guess, you know, you can't just walk in. You got to know somebody by invitation only, whatever. Apparently, it's, you know, it's not easily accessible. It's probably in the basement of some building somewhere or whatever. But there is a restaurant, apparently. Enough people have talked about it. I've seen a lot of things on YouTube about it. You can actually get served human meat. A lot of the mucky mucks of Hollywood go there, you know, of course, naturally. Apparently, one of their regulars is Katy Perry, from what I hear. Anyway, on a related note, Breitbart.com carried an article on March 13th, 2000, just this past March, 2018, entitled Richard Dawkins Suggests Eating Human Flesh to Overcome Cannibalism Taboo. Get rid of your taboo about cannibalism. All you got to do is become a cannibal. Just, you know, eat human flesh. You know, the first time it'll grow through out, the second time you might still be throwing up. By the third time, it'll become routine. Then you won't have such a fear of it anymore, and you'll accept it. And when you hear shocking stories about it, they won't shock you anymore. This article stated, professional atheist Richard Dawkins continues to push the envelope, proposing that cultivating and eating human meat might help society overcome its taboo against cannibalism. And isn't that something you've always wanted to do? Well, there's the solution. Yay, finally. I've been wondering how I was going to get over that silly fear of mine. The article continued, commenting on an article from the UK's independent newspaper, which touts the benefits of lab-grown clean meat. Lab-grown. Dawkins tweeted earlier this month that perhaps something similar could be done with human flesh. Oh, guys, you can bet they're already doing it. But you know what? They're not interested in lab-grown stuff. No, no, no. They want fresh meat taken from a person they just recently slaughtered on their frickin' Abramovic altar there. Anyway, the article finishes off by saying, which would assist Western culture in shedding yet another irrational remnant of its Judeo-Christian roots. Who the hell said that that's Judeo-Christian? A taboo against eating human flesh? Fuck Judeo-Christian. It's inhuman. It's insanity. It's fucking evil. You don't need Judeo-Christian standards to tell you that, as if Judeo-Christian had fucking moral standards anyway. Yes, there are Christians out there that do have moral standards, but the Judeo-Christian religion itself, that fucking book it's based on, has no goddamn moral standards. That book, more than any other, talks about eating human flesh, doesn't it? The great Yahweh prick in the sky talks all the time about you should eat the flesh and blood of your sons and daughters. You'll eat their flesh and drink their blood. Blah, 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 blah. How many passages I've read like that in the past? Got the shit, Judeo-Christian, my ass. If you're a human being, you're opposed to eating human flesh, and there's nothing irrational about it. What is irrational is the act of eating human flesh, isn't it? Holy Jesus H. Fucking Christ, man. Look how they're trying to normalize everything that is abominable, detestable, vulgar, vomit-inducing, disgusting. They're not going to stop, guys. They're not going to stop until they get it. Ah.
Anyway. Let's see here. Here's another passage from the Not-So-Holy Book. Speaking of cannibalism and Judeo-Christian values. Leviticus 26, verses 27 to 39. Well, actually, I'm going to read several passages here. I don't cite the whole passage. I just cite a small segment of it. But in your own time later, if you want to read the whole thing, it's pretty disgusting. Leviticus 26, verses 27 to 39. I'm just going to read an excerpt from that passage. It says, "And if you will not hearken unto me," this is Yahweh speaking, "but walk contrary unto me, you shall eat the flesh of your sons, and the flesh of your daughters shall you eat." So there you go. One of the passages I was just talking about. Holy shit. Here's another one. Isaiah 9, verse 19 to 20 says, "Though the wrath of the, through the wrath of the Lord, the people shall be as the fuel of the fire, and they shall eat every man the flesh of his own arm." There you go, guys. You know, for you true Bible believers out there, you shouldn't be disgusted or grossed out by parabiosis. God damn it. You have biblical sanction here for doing it. As a matter of fact, if you don't do it, you're rebelling against the great Yahweh. He wants you to do this shit. So suggest to your pastor this week that you have a blood-drinking ceremony. Hey, when you celebrate the communion, get some real blood. God damn it. Isaiah 49:26 says, "And I will feed them that oppress thee with their own flesh, and they shall be drunken with their blood as with sweet wine." Ooh, yummy, yum, yum. "And all flesh shall know that I, the Lord, am thy Savior and thy Redeemer." Oh, maybe he means that if you eat their flesh and drink their blood, you're going to have immortality. Yeah. I mean, that's what Jesus taught, right? "Except you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you." Jesus claims you got to eat his flesh and drink his blood to have life, right? So there you go. That's why Yahweh's the Redeemer. He has you eat flesh and drink blood that gives you youthfulness. You must drink and the blood and eat the flesh of young children, of course. Maybe that's why Jesus said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." Hmm. "So that you may know that I am the Lord, your Savior and Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob." Ooh! Don't you just want to shit your panties reading a verse like that? Oh, trembling with fear at the great blood drinker and flesh eater himself, at the very thought of his power and his majesty. What a raging piece of shit. You imagine, can you believe I used to bow on my knees and pray to that fucking thing? Oh my God! Wish I could go back in the past and meet my former self and suggest I check in at a local clinic and get a fucking brain transplant. Wow, man. What a monstrosity. Jeremiah 19:9 says, "And I, Yahweh, will cause the flesh of their sons and the flesh of their daughters, and they shall eat everyone the flesh of his friend." I guess, you know, it's not enough to eat your sons and daughters' flesh and drink their blood. Eat your friend's flesh and drink his blood too. Why not? Says the great Yahweh. God damn it. Now do pardon the redundancy. I know in quoting these verses, they're all saying the same thing. But it is necessary to do this just to remind you of how frequent this theme pops up in the Not-So-Holy Book. It would be bad enough if statements like this appeared just once in that goddamn book. But no, they're all over the fucking place. Here's another one. Ezekiel 5, verse 10. "Therefore, the fathers shall eat the sons in the midst of thee, and the sons shall eat their fathers." Oh, now how does that work? If the fathers are eating the sons are eating the fathers, you're not going to have anybody left.
Pretty soon you're going to be down to just two, the father and the son. What, are they going to toss a fucking coin?
Gee, Dad, should I eat you or should you eat me?
Well, I tell you what. I'll start at your feet and you start at mine. We'll meet in the middle. What the fuck? Oh, this book, ladies and gentlemen, is nothing but a collection of hard-on-your-ass toilet paper. They should print it on even finer paper. Then it would be useful, right? It is a little bit abrasive to the ass, but other than that, it serves no other function. It has no other use. No other value. Deuteronomy 28:53. Here's another one. Because of the suffering of your enemy, because of the suffering your enemy will inflict on you during the siege, you will eat the fruit of the womb, the flesh of the sons and daughters the Lord your God has given you. Did you catch that? Yahweh here is saying that because of the suffering that your enemy will afflict on you during the siege. He was telling them that, you know, enemies were going to come in and lay siege to them. But later I'm going to give you victory. Because of them coming in and laying siege, later I'm going to give you the privilege of eating their sons and daughters, the fruit of the womb, says the Lord. Can you fucking believe this shit? Can you believe this shit? This is the God that millions and millions and millions of Christians across this country, yay, around the world, every Sunday morning
or Saturday,
gather together to worship, to pray to, and to sing the praises of. You got to be fucking kidding me. Look at this psychopathic son of a bitch. Yahweh was into parabiosis, ladies and gentlemen. Here's another one. Deuteronomy 28:57. And toward her young one that cometh out from between her feet, meaning giving birth, and toward her children, which she shall bear, for she shall eat them. Yahweh was really into that shit, wasn't it? Here's another one. Lamentations 4, verse 10. The hands of the pitiful women have sodden their own children. They were their meat or their food. Here's another one. 2 Kings 6, verse 28 and 29. This woman said unto me, give my son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow. So we boiled my son and did eat him. And I said unto her on the next day, give thy son now that we may eat him as well. Yes. Well, hey, the tribe had a well-balanced diet, didn't they? They certainly didn't have any shortage of protein in their diet. Apparently never have, all down to the centuries. Blood libel in the Middle Ages, and they're still doing it today. Just ask the boys over at Ambrosia. I'm not done, guys. Here's another one. Micah 3, verses 2 and 3. Who pluck off their skin from off them, and their flesh from off their bones, who also eat the flesh of my people, and flay their skin from off them, and they break their bones, and chop them in pieces, as for the pot, and as flesh within the cauldron. So Yahweh wasn't happy about that here. It was the flesh of his people being eaten. Nevertheless, he loved to talk about the eating of flesh. You realize how many passages, and that's not even all of them. Those are just a few select ones. You realize how many times that piece of detestable shit literature mentions the eating of flesh, the drinking of blood, and of children at that. Children. Parabiosis, ladies and gentlemen. Just saw the verse I read a moment ago where Yahweh said, because they have laid siege to you, I will give them for your food. You will eat the flesh of their sons and their daughters, the fruit of the womb. You will eat it. Parabiosis, folks, what it is. Isn't it amazing how Bible dupes are so opposed to cannibalism, and yet their holy book, all the while, wholeheartedly embraces this. But do notice how the emphasis in most of these passages about eating flesh and drinking blood was on children's blood and flesh being drunk and eaten. Unbelievable, guys. Anyway, that concludes our discussion on parabiosis. Pretty sick stuff. So remember that that statement yesterday I read from Bourdain's girlfriend. You know, she said she's got the picture of the young girl in the red shoes. Remember, red shoes usually is symbolic of pedophilia. And she says, now me and Mr. Bourdain will not get old because the angels are wearing my red shoes. What angels? She's talking about little children, right? She's talking about parabiosis there, ladies and gentlemen. Now you can understand what she meant by that. Now me and Mr. Bourdain won't get old. Why? Because we're eating the flesh and drinking the blood of little children. Look at, remember all the pictures I mentioned yesterday with blood? This picture of her with blood all over her face and dripping from her mouth. I mean, come on. Pictures on his website of excised human hearts and another picture of probably him. I don't know. Some guy's hand holding a friggin' heart with blood gushed all over the damn place. Hey! And remember that picture he had of raw, fresh blood soup? I rest my case, guys. I rest my case. There it is. Do you see what's going on now? Do you need any more proof? That was taken right off of his Twitter page, goddammit. He posted it himself. You see what we're dealing with here now. Parabiosis is fucking real. There's a company in California that will hook you up for $8,000. They'll pump your veins with the blood of children, ladies and gentlemen. And now we just saw where the tribe got this philosophy from, right from the Not-So-Holy book. What a sick-ass fucking world we live in. Holy shit. All right, guys. Get off another topic when we get back. Stick with us.
We don't need no thought control. Dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Renegade Broadcasting has a sister site where you can find insightful articles from the past and present, the latest in health and wellness, research, analysis of current events, profound poetry, amazing artwork, lots of videos and podcasts from other content creators, and so much more. We are in a struggle to awaken as many people as possible, put an end to our enslavement in this toxic culture, and create a future where we can be happy, healthy, and free. Go to RenegadeTribune.com, browse the great content, and do consider joining the crew in publishing your own original work.
Guild of Eight Broadcasting.
Guys, welcome back. Yeah, I might as well get into the Chappaquiddick thing now. Like I said, I put these notes together years ago. Just never got around to broadcasting them, but it seems like a good time now. They just came out with that movie, I don't know, a couple months ago, whatever it was, which I saw. And as always, you know, they're not going to give you the behind the scenes. Never. You're never going to get the real story. The movie leaves you with more questions than you ever had before. What a crock of BS. It doesn't make any sense. Well, of course, how could it? The way they presented it back then and the way it's presented in the movie, it's just absolute nonsense. There's no way that happened, guys, the way we were told. Obviously, something was going on. Obviously, there was a cover-up. But who was behind the cover-up? Who killed this woman? And what was the purpose of the murder? That's the question. A lot of people think it was Kennedy himself, was it? Well, let's take a look. For those not familiar with what I'm talking about, the Chappaquiddick incident refers, of course, to the circumstances surrounding the death of young Mary Jo Kopechne, whose body was discovered underwater inside an automobile that belonged to Senator Ted Kennedy. Body and the car were found in a tidal channel on Chappaquiddick Island, Massachusetts, part of Martha's Vineyard, on the morning of July 19th, 1969, 50 years ago, next year. After the discovery, Kennedy gave a statement to police saying that on the previous night, Kopechne was his passenger when he took a wrong turn and accidentally drove his car off of a bridge into the water. That's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, there's just no way you can accidentally drive your car off a bridge. No. That's how people bought that, how they still continue to buy it. I'm not even suggesting that he drove it off on purpose. As we're going to see quite clearly, something else was going on there. But that just doesn't cut it. I think he was made to say that for reasons we'll get into later. Anyway, but keep in mind, this occurred roughly around midnight, and he didn't report it until the next morning. What the hell's up with that? After pleading guilty to a charge of leaving the scene of an accident after causing injury, he received a suspended sentence. Yeah, well, you can bet that was all arranged ahead of time. He was given an ultimatum, but again, I don't want to get ahead of myself. The incident, of course, became a national scandal and undoubtedly was the cause of Kennedy's decision not to run in the 1972 presidential election. And I think you can already see where we're going with this. Not want another Kennedy in office. When Kennedy did make it in, and we know what happened to him, another one had just announced his candidacy for presidency, and boom, they popped him off. And now this guy, see the pattern. Anyway, let's take a look at the party that had taken place prior to this incident. On July 18th, 1969, Ted attended a party on Chappaquiddick. Technically, Chappaquiddick isn't part of Martha's Vineyard. It's actually like a separate island, although they are connected. But anyway, the party was a reunion for a group of six women, including Kopechne, known as the Boiler Room Girls, who had served in his brother Robert's 68 presidential campaign. Also present were Joseph Gargan, Ted's cousin, Paul Markham, a school friend of Gargan's, who had become United States attorney for Massachusetts under the patronage of the Kennedys. Let's see, Charles Tretter was there, an attorney, Raymond LaRosa, and then finally John Crimmins, Ted's part-time driver. Kennedy was also competing in the Edgartown Yacht Club Regatta, a sailing competition which was taking place over several days at the time. According to his own testimony at the inquest into Kopechne's death, Ted left the party at approximately 11:15 p.m. Said that when he announced that he was about to leave, Kopechne told him, quote, that she was desirous of leaving if I would be kind enough to drop her back at her hotel. Kennedy then requested the keys to his car from his chauffeur, Crimmins, and then when asked why he did not have his chauffeur driver, drive them both, Kennedy explained that Crimmins, along with some other guests, quote, were concluding their meal, enjoying the fellowship, and it didn't appear to me necessary to require him to bring me back to Edgartown. Kopechne told no one that she was leaving with Kennedy and left her purse and hotel key at the party. Left rather in a hurry, apparently. Anyway, let's look at what happened after the party. Christopher Huck Look was a deputy sheriff working as a special police officer at the Edgartown Regatta, at the dance that night. At 12:30 a.m., he left the dance, crossed over to Chappaquiddick in the yacht club's launch, got into his parked car, and drove toward his home, which was south of the Dyke Bridge. He testified that between 12:30 and 12:45 a.m., he had seen a dark car containing a man driving and a woman in the front seat approaching the intersection with Dyke Road. The car had gone first onto the private cemetery road and stopped there. Thinking that the occupants of the car might be lost, Look had gotten out of his car and walked towards it. When he was 25 to 30 feet away, the car started backing up toward him. When Look called out to offer his help, the car took off eastwards toward the ocean down Dyke Road in a cloud of dust. Look recalled that the car's license plate began with an L and contained the number 7 twice, both details being true of Kennedy's 67 Oldsmobile. So, you know, clearly that was the car. According to his inquest testimony, Kennedy made a wrong turn onto Dyke Road, an unlit dirt road that led to Dyke Bridge. Dyke Road was unpaved, but Kennedy, driving at approximately 20 miles an hour, took no particular notice of this fact and did not realize that he was no longer headed toward the ferry landing. I find, again, this hard to believe because, folks, they, you know, other than the Cape, they lived on the Vineyard. They spent a lot of time there. They probably knew every frickin' road like the back of their hand. Anyway, Dyke Bridge was a wooden bridge angled obliquely to the road with no guardrail. That is true. Didn't have a guardrail, which is pretty stupid. But anyway, a fraction of a second before he reached the bridge, Kennedy applied his brakes, he said. He then drove over the side of the bridge. The car plunged into tide-swept Poocha Pond at that location. It's basically a channel. And came to rest upside down underwater. Now, you know, I don't even know how deep that water is supposed to have been. But if you saw the movie, it's not very deep. In fact, you could basically stand up in it, for Christ's sakes. And here's the real clincher. Kennedy said that he got out of the car. Had no problem. He got out of the car. He got to the surface or stood up or whatever. I don't think he had to swim much. I don't think it was that deep. But even if it was, it wasn't deep enough that he had trouble swimming to the surface. He said he called out for her and then he, you know, didn't hear her. So he went back down, he claims, and tried to rescue her, but it was too dark. He couldn't see. So then, you know, that's when he ran to go get some help. And when they came back, apparently they couldn't, it was too dark for them. But still, guys, after all that, they didn't call the police. I'm not buying this, but not necessarily because I think Kennedy himself was up to any foul play or that he wanted her dead. I mean, that possibility exists, but when you look at some of the other circumstances we're going to be checking out here, there's a lot more to this story. Anyway, but here's the real clincher with his story. You would think that, you know, his handlers or whatever would have come up with a better line than this. He said that he escaped, right? He got out of the car. How did he do it? Did he open the door? Was his window down? Who knows? But he got out of his car and was able to get to the surface and catch his breath. If he was able to do that, why wasn't Kopechne able to do it? She didn't pass out from the accident, bump her head, and get knocked out because the police said that she was found pushing herself upward to catch her breath from a bubble of air that was in the car. Well, that presents another problem, doesn't it? How could there have been a bubble of air in the car if Kennedy opened either the door or the window to get out of the car? You see my point? That bubble of air would have exited the car and gone to the surface. Obviously, he could not have been in the car. I'm getting ahead of myself here. We'll get into that some more later, but there's no way that he was in the car. Anyway. Kennedy later recalled that he was able to swim free of the vehicle, but Kopechne was not. Kennedy claimed at the inquest that he called Kopechne's name several times from the shore, then tried to swim down to reach her seven or eight times, after which time he rested on the bank for around 15 minutes before returning on foot to Lawrence Cottage, where the party attended by Kopechne and other boiler room girls had occurred. Again, this just doesn't add up. He claims he wasn't drinking either. If you go to a party, of course you're drinking. He's going to just rest for 15 minutes. This is an emergency situation. Every minute that goes by, you know, the person is closer to death. You know, you can't waste any time here. I can't believe that people bought this story. There's no question he was lying, but why was he lying? That's the question. He denied seeing any house with a light on during his journey back to Lawrence Cottage, he said. In addition to the working telephone at the Lawrence Cottage, according to one commentator, his route back to the cottage would have taken him past four houses from which he could have telephoned and summoned help. He didn't do that. Again, this whole thing isn't adding up. You know why I think this story isn't adding up? I don't think he was there. There in the car. I don't think he had anything to do with the car incident at all, but we'll get to that after. The first of these houses, referred to as Dyke House, was 150 yards away from the bridge and was occupied by Sylvia Malm and her family at the time of the incident. Malm later stated that she had left a light on at the residence when she retired for that evening. So, again, there's something wrong here. I don't think he said there was no lights, he couldn't see any house with any lights because he didn't, because he's lying about not seeing a house. I think he's lying that he was there at all. I don't think he was there at all. According to Kennedy's testimony, Gargan and party co-host Paul Markham then returned with Kennedy to the waterway to attempt to rescue Kopechne. But by this time, guys, come on. He said he had already rested for 15 minutes on shore. Then he proceeded to go over to the house where the party was. I mean, what the hell is going on with that? Why even bother bringing a team to rescue her at that point? You're going to be dead within less than, 3 or 4 minutes, 5 at the max, right? She'd long since drowned by this time. So what the hell were they going back there to rescue? How come the blame is always put on Kennedy? Why didn't he call the police? How come nobody else called the police if this story played out the way we're being told? None of them called the police by this time?
Well, wait, how long ago was this, Ted? Well, let's see. I rested for about 12 minutes on shore.
She's dead! That would make them accessories too, right? To not report it? I mean, this is just unbelievable. Both of the other men also tried to dive into the water, we're told, to rescue Kopechne multiple times. Again, rescue. What kind of rescue was that? She's dead. She's long since dead. When their efforts failed, according to Kennedy's testimony, Gargan and Markham drove with Kennedy to the ferry landing, both insisting multiple times that the accident had to be reported to the authorities. What good does it do for them to say that they insisted it had to be reported when they never freaking actually did that until 8 o'clock the next goddamn morning? According to Markham's testimony, Kennedy was sobbing and on the verge of breaking down. He went on to testify that, quote, "I had full intention of reporting it." What good does it say? What good does it do to say that?
I had full intention of reporting it.
The bottom line is you didn't report it. And I mentioned to Gargan and Markham something like, "You take care of the other girls. I will take care of the accident." That is what I said. And I dove into the water. Yeah, well, that doesn't explain, once again, why you never reported it. Kennedy had already told Gargan and Markham not to tell the other women anything about the incident. Quote, "because I felt strongly that if these girls were noticed, if these girls were notified that an accident had taken place and Mary Jo had, in fact, drowned, that it would only be a matter of seconds before all of these girls who were long and dear friends of Mary Jo's would go to the scene of the accident and enter the water with, I felt, a good chance that some serious mishap might occur to any one of them." So, I suppose he was out of concern that he didn't want them to know. Again, guys, none of this is adding up. None of this is adding up. Why would they even think of diving in, realizing how much time had gone by? There's no point now. All you do from there is call the police and have them rescue a corpse from the car. Can you imagine if you or I told a story like this in court under circumstances like this? They'd freaking hang us by the neck, right? We wouldn't stand a chance in freaking hell of getting out of this. He was totally, the whole group was totally let off the hook, but why is the question? And was there any foul play on the part of Kennedy or any of his buddies? I don't think so, for reasons we're going to see later. Anyway, Gargan and Markham would later testify that they assumed that Kennedy was going to inform the authorities once he got back to Edgartown, and thus did not do so themselves. Well, the same excuse worked the other way, you know, and that's what was shown in the movie. Kennedy was upset with them. I thought you were going to report this to the police. Why didn't you? And they were dumping the blame on him.
Well, you were supposed to do it.
Oh, cut the crap, man. Anyway, we got somebody in the line now. You there, caller? Well, he's either unmuting his phone or he's just calling in to listen. I guess he's calling to listen. All right, anyway. Yeah, are you there, caller?
Hi. Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I just was digging my phone out of my pocket. I could just listen. I just called in, so I don't really know where it's going unless you're willing to maybe take some questions or something.
Yeah, well, it's kind of early yet. I haven't really gotten into the thicket of it, but
That's what I was saying. So I'll just keep listening. Maybe later. If I have a question later.
Yep, no problem, man.
Okay, thanks.
Anyway, according to Kennedy's sworn testimony, Kennedy swam across the 500-foot channel back to Edgartown and returned to his hotel room, where he removed his clothes and collapsed on his bed until, you know, the next morning, at which time he finally notified the police. Guys, I am willing to bet that Kennedy was in that hotel room the whole time. He was never by the bridge, never in the car, had no connection whatsoever. He was made to take the fall for this, as I'll get to later. I mean, this story is just, it's so completely full of crap. Even if he was, let's pretend that he was, you know, having an affair with this woman and, you know, he didn't want the truth to get out. And so he figured, I'll just kill her to shut her up. You're going to come up with a better goddamn alibi than that. You know what I'm saying? And your henchmen are going to come up with a better alibi. This thing is just so full of crap. You know why they didn't try to make the story sound more convincing? This is the one they were told to say, and they were told, don't worry about it. We're going to take care of everything. You just need to take the fall for this so that it will ruin your chance for the presidency. That's it. They couldn't kill him. They already killed his two brothers. They couldn't do it a third time. They needed an excuse, something to hang him with to destroy his reputation.
Oh, don't worry. You'll still have a life in politics. You can be senator the rest of your life, but you're not going to go in the White House.
That's it, guys. That's it. That's what. Exactly what we're looking at here. And this isn't the first time they tried to fuck him up. They did something to him a few years earlier, too. We'll get into that later, but probably not tonight. But anyway, hearing noises, he said, he later put on dry clothes and asked someone what the time was. It was something like 2:30 a.m., the senator recalled. He testified that as the night went on, I almost tossed and turned and walked around that room. I had not given up hope all night long that by some miracle, Mary Jo would have escaped from the car. Back in his hotel, Kennedy complained at 2:55 a.m. to the hotel owner that he had been awoken by a noisy party. By 7:30 a.m. the next morning, he was talking casually to the winner of the previous day's sailing race with no indication that anything was amiss. So you see what's going on here. I don't think he knew what the hell had happened the night before. You get up, 7:30, ran into somebody. Hey, yeah, how'd it go? Well, what happened? You know, blah, 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 blah. Showed no sign of any, you know, stress or anxiety. Anyway, at 8 a.m., Gargan and Markham joined Kennedy at his hotel, where they had a heated conversation, we're told. According to Kennedy's testimony, the two men asked why he had not reported the incident. Kennedy responded by telling them, quote, about my own thoughts and feelings as I swam across that channel, that somehow when they arrived in the morning, that they were going to say that Mary Jo was still alive. In the movie, he was portrayed as yelling at them for not calling the police. I don't know if that is Hollywood or what. But anyway, the three men subsequently crossed back to Chappaquiddick Island on the ferry, where Kennedy made a series of phone calls from a payphone by the crossing. The phone calls were to his friends for advice, and again, he did not report the accident to the authorities by this time. So actually, I said 8 a.m., but no, this is way past 8 a.m. now. We still haven't reported it. Unbelievable. Earlier that morning, two amateur fishermen had seen the submerged car in the water and notified the inhabitants of the cottage nearest to the scene, who then called the authorities at around 8:20. So apparently they were the one. I guess Kennedy made his call after the police already knew. Edgartown Police, I put these notes together so long ago I forgot. Edgartown Police Chief Jim Arena traveled quickly to the scene and discovered that a body was inside the car. He then dove into the water, but was unsuccessful in freeing the body. Arena then summoned a professional diver along with a tow truck with a winch. The diver, John Farrer, arrived around 8:45 a.m. The car was quickly towed from the water. Farrer later testified at the inquest that Kopechne's body was pressed up in the car in the spot where an air bubble would have formed. So, yeah. She felt trapped in the car. She couldn't get out, so she was struggling for air. She wasn't unconscious, but she found no way to escape the vehicle. So how did Kennedy supposedly get out? He wasn't in the car, ladies and gentlemen. Was not in the car. All right, guys, short break. Be right back.
Here's Jewish professor Noel Ignatieff.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacy. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate. Not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.
Traveling down the road, my friend.
All right, guys, welcome back. Barr said that he believes there was enough air originally in the car that Kopechne could have sustained herself under there for anywhere between an hour and even up to possibly 2 hours. And that if, you know, the police were called right away, they could definitely have gotten out of there, gotten her out of there in time, you know, to save her life. Imagine that. But I don't fault Kennedy for not calling the police because, like I said, I don't think he was there at all, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think he was there at all. Why would he say, oh, I didn't see any houses. There weren't any lights. I did, you know, clearly there were lights. He wouldn't be so bold as to lie like that because he would know that, yeah, the woman whose house was nearby that did have lights on would testify and blow that out of the water. If it happened the way we were told. No, it didn't happen the way we were told. He was lying, but he was made to lie. And he wasn't worried about getting caught at that point in his lies because he knew they were going to cover for him, that he wasn't going to get in trouble. He didn't do anything anyway. I don't believe he did a thing at all. He was not responsible for this woman's death. I'm not a Ted Kennedy fan by any means, by the way. I can't stand the weaselly little son of a bitch. But they ruined him, guys. They destroyed him. Years of selling his conscience out absolutely destroyed him. I believe he had, you know, the same character his brothers had. But this whole Kopechne thing was designed to destroy him, and it did. It totally ruined him. He became a classic liberal piece of shit. Anyway, not that I like the conservatives either, but, you know what I'm saying. He's a complete sellout, complete lying fraud artist. Sucked as senator. But that's how he saved his hide, you know. Guess he felt he didn't have a choice at the time. You either take the fall for this and, it ruins your presidency, or we're going to frame you for this murder. Look at all this evidence against you. You think this is going to stand up in court unless we pull some strings for you? You're going to be put away for life. So it's your choice. Take the fall, give up your idea of becoming president, and, we'll make sure you fly through this smoothly, or you're going to go away the rest of your life. She was murdered to shut him up. And we'll get into the evidence of that more later, but it's pretty obvious, guys, what went on here. Anyway, at 10 a.m., Kennedy... just prior to that time, he actually did phone in only because he had found out that the body was discovered. Only then did he decide to call the police station. At 10 a.m., he entered the police station in Edgartown, made a couple of phone calls, and then dictated a statement to his aide, Paul Markham, which was then given to the police. The statement ran as follows. On July 18th, 1969, at approximately 11:15 p.m. in Chappaquiddick, I was driving my car on Main Street, blah, blah. I don't have to go into all this. I pretty much already related, what he had said. He was taking the fall for it. Apparently, at first, he didn't want to say that he was doing the driving, but he then changed his mind later. Wow, I just saw that the organizer, which is Kyle, dropped. Not good. I hope I'm still on here. That's unusual. Well, anyway, I hope I'm still coming over the air. By the way, I had a couple people email me yesterday saying that they couldn't get my show live, that there was something else being broadcast. I only had two people tell me that, though, so I don't know if that was a problem across the board or was that just with those couple listeners. I don't know. But in any case, it was recorded. It's in the archive. Anyway, on July 25th, 7 days after the incident, Kennedy entered a plea of guilty to a charge of leaving the scene of an accident after causing injury, as I said before. Kennedy's attorney suggested that any jail sentence should be suspended, and the prosecutors agreed to this, citing Kennedy's age, character, and prior reputation. Come on, what a crock is that? Give me a break. This whole story, guys, if it played out the way that they told us, there's no way anybody, not even Mr. Kennedy, could have gotten away with this. They would have sent him up the freaking river, baby. This was all arranged ahead of time to let him sail scot-free. That's it. All there is to it. Judge James Boyle sentenced Kennedy to 2 months incarceration, the statutory minimum for the offense, which he suspended. Oh, please. In announcing the sentence, Boyle referred to Kennedy's unblemished record. Again, you got to love that. Yeah, right. Like, that's going to work for any of us, right? You can have an unblemished record, and suddenly you go on a drunken spree and kill somebody, and now you're going to go away forever. They're not going to cite your unblemished record. What a crock of shit. Anyway, in announcing the sentence, Boyle referred to Kennedy's unblemished record and said that, quote, he has already been and will continue to be punished far beyond anything this court can impose. What a crock. The judge was reading off a goddamn script, doing what he was told to do. Give me a break, guys. It shows how completely rigged. Now, there are instances where this has happened too, right? If you're well connected enough, doesn't matter what your crime is, you're gonna sail scot-free. But look at the phoniness of this. It's so in your face. If this played out the way we were told, this guy's as guilty as sin. He's guilty on numerous counts, just on the basis of the fact that he didn't freaking report it. And that he claims there were no lights on when the woman said, yeah, my house, my lights were on all night. I mean, God damn it, what a phony-ass system we've got. Anyway, the medical examiner, Dr. Donald Mills, was satisfied, he said, that the cause of death was accidental drowning. Well, obviously, she drowned, but was it accidental? He signed a death certificate. Yeah, again, why didn't anybody, well, we know why, because they were told what to say, but nevertheless, how is it that the question was never raised? How the hell did he get out of the car, but she couldn't? Anyway, the coroner signed a death certificate to the effect of accidental death, and released Kopechne's body to her family without ordering an autopsy. That's interesting. Later on September 18th, District Attorney Edmund Dennis attempted to secure an exhumation of Kopechne's body in order to perform a belated autopsy, citing blood found on Kopechne's skirt and in her mouth and nose, quote, which may or may not be consistent with death by drowning. That's interesting. The reported discovery of the blood was made when her clothes were turned over to authorities by the funeral director. How the hell did nobody notice that before? A Pennsylvania court under Judge Bernard Rominski held a hearing on the request on October 20th to the 21st. The request was opposed by Kopechne's parents. That's strange. Eventually, Judge Berminski had ruled against the exhumation on December 10th, saying that there was, quote, no evidence that anything other than drowning had caused the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Why would the parents refuse that? That's pretty bizarre. Were they threatened? Back off? On April 6th, 1970, Dukes County Grand Jury assembled in special session to consider Kopechne's death. Judge Wilfred Packett instructed the members of the grand jury that they could consider only those matters brought to their attention by the Superior Court, the district attorney, or their own personal knowledge. Nothing outside of that. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, but there's no cover-up here.
And this cover-up, guys, was not to protect Kennedy. I'll tell you that right now. Citing the orders of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, Packett told the grand jury that it could not see the evidence or Judge Boyle's report from the inquest, which at that time were still impounded. Anyway, District Attorney Dennis, who had attended the inquest and seen Judge Boyle's report, told the grand jury that there was not enough evidence to indict Senator Kennedy on potential charges of manslaughter, perjury, or driving to endanger. So, you know, it looked here like they were protecting Kennedy. They really weren't. They were just fulfilling a promise. We'll make sure you don't go down. They weren't protecting him out of concern for him, in other words. They were protecting him out of concern for them, you know, for themselves, that he wouldn't spill the beans, that something else went on, that he wasn't even present. And, of course, in return for, you know, him agreeing to back down and forget his bid for the presidency. The grand jury called four witnesses who had not testified at the inquest. They testified for a total of 20 minutes, but no indictments were issued. Again, just another rigged kangaroo court session. What we have discussed up to this point is the official story. But as always, there's much, much more to it than that, which we didn't hear about on the evening news for some strange reason. The first impression many might draw is that Ted killed Kopechne. That seems the most obvious conclusion, just looking at the story the way it's been sold to us. However, understanding the political climate of the day will lead us to think along much deeper lines. The elites, if you will, we know who they are, did not like the Kennedys, it goes without saying. They had already killed his two brothers, of course, Ted's two brothers. And now, again, in fear of Ted running for the presidency, they had to take him down. That's all there is to it. But this time, they would not do it via assassination. That would be too obvious, right? Too risky, since the public was already suspicious about the other two brothers. Instead, they would set him up to take a fall that, again, would destroy his presidential aspirations, destroy his chance at the presidency. What it looks like is that Kopechne was murdered and Ted, again, was set up to take the blame. To ensure his compliance, he was probably threatened with harm to his family or that he would be sent away for life. For murder. This would explain the blood found on Kopechne's body. It seems quite apparent that she didn't die from drowning, or that they just knocked her out, and then later, after the car went over, maybe the cold water brought her to. She tried to get air, but was unable to, you know, to open the doors. Anyway, this, of course, is all easy to pull off when you've got a bought-off legal system, which was obviously the case here. I think there's a caller. Oh, no, there isn't. There's a caller. Ted was promised that he would be found innocent and that he could continue his career in Massachusetts, again, as long as he forever kept his mouth shut, did what he was told, and did not ever raise the question about either of his brother's death. No wonder he pushed for and supported so many sleazy pieces of legislation over the years, folks, including Obama's scandalous health care bill, He did what he was told. End of story. They completely ruined the man. The truth is, Ted could not have been in that car. How are we supposed to believe that he was able to climb out of his car window once again when the car was upside down and water was supposedly rushing in? On top of that, it was a dark, moonless night. And then he walks past houses with lights on, as well as a firehouse, and doesn't ask for use of the phone to get help. None of this makes any damn sense. Obviously, again, I'm not sticking up for him and saying he didn't, when I say he didn't kill her. Although I do believe at this time he had somewhat of a conscience. I think he was, on a par with his two brothers at that time. But because of this incident, guys, they ruined him. If not right away, over the next several years of having to, by force, they had him backed into a corner. Over time, when you're made to suppress your conscience and do things that violate your conscience, after a while, it's not even going to matter anymore. You're not even going to care anymore. You're going to become the very piece of shit that the pieces of shit forced you to become. You're going to become just like them. And that's what he became. Later in life, the man was an absolute piece of shit. But unfortunately, I see that he didn't have any choice in the matter, unless he simply, refused to go along with their little scheme, in which case they either would have killed him or he would have, gone up the river for the rest of his life. Not very good choices. But how could he have met with friends the next morning and been calm, not mentioning anything about the night before, talk to the guy in the yacht tournament, the competition or whatever, not being nervous, not showing any sign of, because he didn't know at the time what had happened. Didn't find out until, probably around 8:30 when he was on the phone and some friends told him, hey, did you know that your car was found off the bridge and Kopechne's body was in it? That's when he found out, and that's why only then did he call the police. It's fucking obvious. There's no way that story played out, guys, the way we were told. No way. Absolutely no freaking way. The whole thing is complete bullshit. Of course he lied, but he had to lie. He had to. He was told to do it. And again, guys, that story would never have flown except that the whole system was in their pocket. And they knew that from the judge to the lawyers to right on down to the goddamn local coroner, you name it, the local police chief, everybody was in their pocket. They all knew what their role was. They all played the role exactly as they were told. And that's how they were able to pull this off. Otherwise, no way. Absolutely. Anyway, there's many reasons why the official bunk story cannot be true. Let's review a few more of these here. The skid marks are perfectly straight, showing no sign of swerving. Why didn't Ted, if he was driving the car, why didn't he turn the wheel at all to avoid going off the bridge? Also, if he was only going at 22 miles an hour, why were the skid marks 17 feet long on the gravel road and another 25 feet on the bridge? For all we know, these skid marks were faked. I think she was passed out. That's why there was blood, right? I think they bludgeoned her, knocked her out, stuffed her in the car, and then pushed the car off the bridge, made the skid marks. And notice the skid marks were straight. They weren't swerving to avoid going off. They were fake. The skid marks were not from that car. But, you can pull this off when you don't have a real investigation, right? When you don't have an autopsy, They probably put, they either ran the car off the bridge or they had her passed out in it and put a brick on the friggin' gas pedal. And then later, when the cop came, he removed the brick like he was told to do, for all we know. The car literally flew about 30 feet into the air. How could this happen when traveling only at 22 miles an hour? They knew, you know, it flew 30 feet in the air because of the distance that it landed. And why wasn't any of this questioned in court? Again, because it was a scam. That's why the whole thing was set up. And the car had to be going at least 40 miles an hour, folks, to travel 36 feet. I mean, this thing is genius to see. This whole thing is complete horseshit. The windshield of Ted's car was smashed with all the shattered glass on the inside. Keep in mind that there were no guardrails on the bridge. So what the hell did this car hit? Or better yet, you know, was this even his car? Or are we just told it was? Anyway. All of the right panels on the car were violently pushed in, not likely from a car traveling at only 22 miles an hour. But again, what could have done this type of damage when the car supposedly just drove off the bridge with no guardrails? If it drove off the bridge, it wouldn't have gone so far, especially only 20 miles an hour, 22 miles an hour. And what would have caused the front panels to be pushed in, guys? This whole thing, again, the fact that the panels were pushed in, yeah, maybe it was rammed off. Another car rammed into it, deliberately pushed it off. The rear view mirror on the driver's side, the other side of the car, was hanging on by only one bolt. Now, how can that be? How can you have damage on both sides of the car, right? This doesn't make any sense. Ted's injuries were suspicious, as though he was simply struck on the head and kicked in the back. Didn't have any serious injuries. Remember how he showed up at the wake or the funeral or whatever, you know, with a neck brace? It was all fake. He didn't have any serious neck injury at all. Popecny's blood alcohol level was 0.10. Totally inconsistent with her behavior. All of her friends said that she was a non-drinker. So, you know, did they force her to take some alcohol? Is that how they knocked her out? Or they forced her to take some alcohol and then knocked her out by bludgeoning her? Who knows? And, you know, they just wanted the alcohol in her system so it could look like she was passed out and, you know, that's how she wasn't able to swim out of the car. In addition to blood being found on her body, 3 weeks after the incident, residual traces of blood were also discovered on the back of her blouse, down both sleeves, and around her collar. So, quite a few blood spots, quite a bit of blood was shed. Perhaps the murderers injected her with alcohol and then damaged a major artery in her neck. Who knows? Christopher Look said that he saw Ted's car at 1:30 a.m., yet Ted said that he drove the car off the bridge at about 11:30. Big problem there. Of course, the long time passage before the accident was reported gave the real perpetrators plenty of time to remove key pieces of evidence that it was a murder. But apparently, they didn't do a thorough enough job. There's still a lot of indications here that something definitely was amiss and that the official story, as always, is complete bunk. So who did it? Who else but most likely the CIA, who hated all the Kennedys. And They certainly had some help from the FBI, as always. Don't forget that J. Edgar Hoover also hated the Kennedys. But here's some food for thought. On one of Nixon's Watergate tapes, dated March 13, 1973, we find this interesting exchange between Nixon and John Wesley Dean III, White House counsel to Nixon. Dean says, if they get these bank records between the start of July of 1969 through June of 1971, there comes Chappaquiddick with a vengeance. Nixon says something unintelligible, and then Dean responds, if they get to it, that is going to come out, and this whole thing can turn around on that. If Kennedy knew what a bear trap he was walking into. Well, there we go. There we go. They set him up. They set him up, ladies and gentlemen. No question about it. Now let's look at another attempt that was made years earlier, 5 years earlier, in fact, on his life, Ted Kennedy's life. He barely survived a terrible plane crash in 1964, just a few months after John Kennedy's assassination. Was this crash arranged like the JFK Jr. crash in 1999? Anyway, in addition to Ted, the plane that he was on when he crashed was occupied by his aide, Edward Moss, Senator Birch Bay, Evans's father, Bay's wife, Marvella, and the pilot, Edwin Zinni. The crash killed Moss and Zinni. And we did survive, of course. Anyway, what do you know, we're out of time. I'm almost done with this. I only got like a page and a half left. All right, guys, we'll have to finish this up on Wednesday, and we'll be off on to something else. But I think the case is closed on this one. They definitely set him up with Jeff Whitting. All right, guys, have a great weekend. We'll catch you on Wednesday. Take care.
Showed me again.
After getting censored relentlessly on YouTube, with video after video and channel after channel getting taken down, we have decided to try a different approach.
We now have RenegadeVids.com, which features all the documentaries, parodies, compilations, sketches, and video discussions that are simply too accurate for the kosher censors.
There are now many hours worth of hard-hitting videos waiting for you to watch and share. So get on over to RenegadeVids.com.